In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is but one God, and I bear witness that Moses, that Abraham, that Muhammad, and Jesus are his servants. We're grateful that each and every one of you with me, that together we're striving to serve in the way of good. I greet you all with the green words of peace. Be said in the Arabic language. As-salamu alaykum.
Alaykum salam.
How's everyone this afternoon? I think we all are aware that these words simply mean in English, peace be unto you. And we want you to know that it is not our intention to proselytize or cause you to join any church, mosque, or cathedral, but that we should organize on the principles of truth. And it just so happens while we're here in church that it is that principle that Jesus used, which is designed to unite the people. For we're taught that the best religion is actually the one that teaches us to do unto others as we would have others to do unto us. Welcome back to the town hall, where we've been gathering because it has not been done unto us as others have done unto themselves. And so, as you know, we are fresh back, just off the plane from Los Angeles, California, where the murder trial of Johannes Mezeli has now begun. The attorneys, the district attorney and the defense attorney, have both given their opening statements. Witnesses for the prosecution are currently being examined, thank you, and cross-examined by the defense. If I could share with you just a glimpse of what it was that we are experiencing, you know, I want us to clearly understand that victory in this case is not guaranteed. In fact, we should also clearly understand that the prosecutor in this case is the underdog. In other words, if this were the NBA championship, this would be the equivalent of a series being played right now between the Lakers and the Warriors. The Warriors would in fact be clearly an underdog. The Warriors don't have Kobe. The Warriors don't have those other players. They used to have, what's the brother's name?
Shaq.
Derek Fisher. The Warriors, I don't know if they played. I watched the game the other night, the first time I've seen a championship basketball game in quite a few months or years. But the Warriors in the current position are clearly not the equal of the Lakers nor the Celtics. And that's only to suggest how big of a mountain is it that we must climb to see the prosecution of Johannes Mezeli. We, of course, know that Johannes Mezeli is the first peace officer in California state history to be bound over for trial for a murder charge while in the commission of his duty. I took some time, and I want to thank publicly Sister Erica, who has been responsible for the email systems that we have been using for the town hall, where she and another sister had gone into their pockets to make it possible for that email system. And you've not seen that email because they weren't able to continue to invest in that system financially on their own. But my point here is that Sister Erica did a little research for me. I asked her to tell me and find out for me how many police officers in the country have faced these kind of charges. How many of our people or people have been victimized in what's called justifiable homicide. And if you were to look at the Department of Justice report that I looked at, the report itself was offensive to me because everyone that police have killed, they have been called justifiable homicides. Therefore, the victims of police killings are automatically termed in the Justice Department language as felons. In other words, if Johannes Mezelie's murder of Oscar Grant is called justifiable homicide, when the Justice Department takes hold of the numbers, it will declare that Oscar Grant is a felon. Well, okay. Was Sean Bell a felon? Was Malice Green a felon? So now we can go through cases where law enforcement have murdered people and the victims of law enforcement murdered because law enforcement officers are rarely convicted of anything. For whatever it is that they do, the victims of law enforcement shootings are called felons in the Justice Department record. Well, we've got a big mountain to climb. Thought I would go a little further and find out how many police officers have been convicted of murder. What I found out is that there were 9 since the 1800s. And of those that have been convicted of murder, none of them were convicted of murder for what they did while on duty. So you had some officers that went postal, they call it. Went home and killed their family. That has happened. You've got domestic disputes that have led police officers to the point of a murder. You've got other police officers, particularly out of the New York and Chicago areas, that were involved with the mafia and went out on behalf of the mafia and committed hits. That happened around the Gambino family. That in New York, you had that happen around the mafia families of Chicago. No police officer in the history of the country has ever been convicted while on duty for a shooting, a murder that occurred while they were in fact on duty. Not one has been convicted of murder. And I know some are thinking, what about Malice Green? Some might remember that in Detroit, a man was killed, Malice Green, by a couple of police officers. But they were not convicted of murder. By the time they went through trial, 2 officers found varying levels of manslaughter charges. Each of them challenged those charges, and by the time one of the challenges met the courtroom, and even though the court determined that you are in fact guilty, his time had already been served. That man did about 4 years in jail for killing Malice Green, for manslaughter. His partner did a few more than 4 years for killing Malice Green, for manslaughter. So what now is it that we're confronted with? We're confronted with a system that is not designed to prosecute its own. The judges are not accustomed to having to prosecute a police officer. The district attorneys are surely not accustomed to prosecuting a police officer. Thus, it took Tom Orloff weeks to figure out that he should bring a charge that anybody that saw the videotape shooting of Oscar Grant knew that a charge should have been brought immediately. What was so difficult for Mr. Orloff that would make him to retire, by the way? Before he had to end his career on the case of the century. One that would determine whether or not this system actually is willing to prosecute its own bad apples. Well, let's take a look at it. We went in and we were able to participate in the opening arguments of both District Attorney and Prosecutor Stein. On day one of the opening argument, present there was the new district attorney, Nancy O'Malley. Why would I call her Nancy O'Malley? And she assured me that they brought the whole team down to fight this case. As I said to her, Miss O'Malley, we need to fight this case. And those were my words to her. She said, we brought the whole team. We've got 15 people down here. Well, Mr. Stein made a decent opening argument. Could have been a little stronger, but it was decent. He raised the points that the murder of Oscar Grant was not produced by Oscar and his friends, but that the murder of Oscar Grant was produced by police officers gone wild. He didn't use those words. He used the terms chaos, disorder, distrust, and one other term that he expressed was produced by the involvement of the BART officers. However, Mr. Raines made it clear that Anthony Peroni is not on trial. Johannes Mezzali is. But the chaos that was produced clearly began with the contact made by Anthony Peroni with Oscar and his friends. Now, you know, the question of even the initial contact, see, there's historical context to the contact itself that goes deep into policing in the United States. One of those reports on justifiable homicides, this one coming from the USA Today, talks about the fact that in a short span of years, I think it was 1976 to 1998, there was an average justifiable homicide per year of about 400 victims. Of those 400 victims of justifiable homicide, some 35% of the victims of justifiable homicide in the country are black males. Now, black males make up, around about 5 or 6% of the country's population. So it looks like the only place where integration works is prison and police produce homicide. The Justice Department made it clear to point out, well, black males are also responsible for the shootings of more police than other people. So that's because we get shot at more than other people. If you get shot at more, you'll shoot back more. And I think that the system is very clear on that particular point, because in this city, a young man, Lavelle Mixon, engaged that very encounter. You get shot at more, you will shoot back more. So now we're looking at the DA attempting to raise an argument to do what no district attorney has ever done before. That is to actually try a police officer for the murder of a citizen, and in this instance, of a young black male who now, for perhaps one of the few times in history, has to be defended by a system that traditionally prosecutes young black males. Now, the prosecutor has the awesome task of having to defend the humanity of a young black male. Let's think of the new genre or the new position the DA has to take, given that position is not taken any other time of the year. So now we're in the heart of it. Mr. Raines' principal argument is that his man made a mistake. He's going to bring in the experts, they claim, quote unquote, in police stress and psychology, and the experts in the use of the taser. He's going to take time to contradict himself, by the way. He contradicted himself, Mr. Raines, a few times in the opening argument, because he argued against the use of video by the DA. But then, in that, the DA showed still footage of Oscar with his hands behind his back, still footage of Oscar holding back his friend, still footage of Mezzali looking at the gun that he was pulling out of the holster. The DA made that in the opening argument. Here is, in fact, he ran several videos in the opening argument. And as the judge said in the earlier hearings, the videos are going to make this case. The jurors were, according to some witnesses, visibly moved by watching the video in that opening argument because they had not seen it before, except maybe on the news, but surely not in a variety of angles. Well, what the DA Stein did demonstrate in that opening argument was Meserly clearly looked at the gun. In order to defend that, Mr. Raines argued you can't use a steel shot because you have no sense of time. You don't know how long his eyes were on that gun in a steel folder. Now, of course, they've got the technology to count the time. But the point that Mr. Raines was making was you cannot use a steel folder in a motion picture because it immortalizes, it ingrains in one place a position of that particular person that may not accurately depict how long that they were in this position. Well, Raines turned around and did the same thing in his argument. He said he would bring taser experts who would demonstrate the difference between pulling a weapon from a gun holster and a weapon from a taser holster and how the kinesiological movements are different. Particularly as it involves the use of your thumb. So he took a picture of Meserly with his hand on the gun, with his thumb sticking out. Now he said that the DA shouldn't stop the video and do this. Then he turned around and did it himself. And showed a picture of Meserly with his hand reaching to grip the gun with his thumb sticking out to suggest, you see that thumb there? That means he thought he was pulling his taser because you need your thumb to pull the taser. These were how the opening arguments went on. Well, Mr. Raines has a tough case, but remember, he's a $1 million lawyer. He knows how to throw the kitchen sink at a jury because you only have to stick on one. They would then bring in the witnesses. By the way, Mr. Raines also included in his argument that Oscar and his friends were vehemently resisting arrest, which of course we all know and is even more clear to me now that they did not. The prosecutor, after these arguments were made, would call the witnesses beginning on Thursday afternoon and into Friday. The witnesses that have been called to this point, all but two, have been witnesses who captured video of the events themselves. The first witness was the county's video technician or expert to validate that what we were looking at were accurate videos transferred into various formats to make them available to the court. That witness was in and out just a few seconds. But then would come the witnesses who took the video that made this case known to the world. So Ms. Vargas came in. Mr. Liu came in. One other videographer whose name is escaping, a young man, Cross, came in. There's one more. And then, of course, Oscar's friend Jamil came in with their video footage. Each of the video witnesses were clear that when asked why did they start taping, was because of the behavior of the BART officers. Each of them were clear that what prompted them to tape was not the behavior of Oscar and his friends, but what made them roll the tape were the actions of principally Tony Perrone, who, according to all of them, was overly aggressive from the beginning. It was New Year's. There was a lot of noise on the train already. Evidently, Tony Perrone's noise was more impactful on them than the noise of all the New Year's revelers. He came banging on the windows. He came cussing at the passengers. He came declaring this to be his train and he wants you to get your rear end off the train. So the reality was that it were the actions of Tony Peroni that excited the interest of everyone that took video. Interestingly enough, some of the videographers had compassion for the police. Mr. Liu seemed to have a hard time believing that the police were not justified in handling Oscar and his friends the way that they were handled. Though I think he testified better in this record than he did at the preliminary hearing in that regard, in that they captured his voice cussing when he saw what the police were doing to Oscar and his friends. So the DA asked him, "Is that your voice?" "Yes, that's my voice." "Well, why did you do that?" Some may recall in the prior hearing that Mr. Liu kind of expressed his desire to videotape, that he was just an interested photographer. That was his language. "I saw something interesting to capture." Which is fine if you're just a photographer. I do photography, and every now and then I'll drive or ride and see something. "Bring my, stop, take a picture of that flower. Stop, take a picture of that building. Stop, take a picture of that UFO." Whatever. An interested photographer will do that. Now, Mr. Liu attempted to display himself as being simply an interested photographer, but it turned out that when he heard Peroni, he not only videotaped, that man stood up on top of a chair in the bar train. Pardon me, Pastor. I'm sorry. But the man jumped on top of a chair because it was so disturbing to him what he was hearing from Anthony Peroni. And when he looked at Peroni brutalizing Oscar and Michael Greer, he started cussing. So the DA asked him, "Well, why?" "See, that now you're taking it out of 'I'm just an interested photographer' into the fact I'm witnessing something that should not happen." So that even when Raines asked him, "Were they resisting?" He said, "Well, I guess you, they didn't want to sit down. Though I'm not familiar that not sitting down is a charge called resisting arrest." Especially when the videotape clearly showed that Oscar didn't stand up until Tony Peroni slammed Michael Greer. And since Oscar was next in line, he stood up in defense of himself and to talk with him. So this is all to say that what Mr. Raines was after, he got some of. The only thing that he got in his favor is his primary objective, by the way, and that was to get the witnesses to say what they thought Messerly looked like after the shooting. So when the witnesses all said, all but one, all but Jamil, said that he looked confused or dumbfounded. Actually, that may come up in testimony because I think one of them said he looked just like he looks right now. Maybe we should contact the DA and let him know that that was actually said. Evidently, Mr. Messerly is good at keeping a good poker face. You don't know, by the way, what a murderer looks like at face or after they commit the crime. There's no facial expression that says, "I am a murderer." There's no particular facial expression that proves the intent or lack of intent of an action of a crime of murder. There is no particular facial expression. I hope the DA will take that on. Because the defense desire will be, and he's already said it, that he's going to bring in psychologists that deal with police use of force issues. They're going to say things like this. I just read this. This is a report from Cincinnati Dayton Daily News by Lynn Holzer. Cincinnati tops list of police killings. And it is here that you find some of the argument the police offer for themselves when they murder people. It says, nationally, police killed an average of 373 criminal suspects a year between 1976 and 1998, according to the U.S. Department of Justice report on justifiable homicides by police. Most often, these were white males, the shooter. But black males, pardon me, the victims. The primary victim of justifiable homicide is, in fact, white males. But black males made up a disproportionate number of the deaths. But the report released in March also found that the rate at which blacks are killed by police is declining, they claim, with 4.8 black suspects killed per 1 million in the population in 1998 compared to 8 per million in 1978. The rate for whites changed little. Now, Professor David Harris of the University of Toledo College of Law said, the fact that the African Americans are overrepresented is not surprising. There are more contacts between African Americans and law enforcement on a per capita basis than there are between police and whites. When we're talking about an officer-initiated contact, that's going to translate into more potential of this kind of conflict. Harris said, without the details of each shooting, however, it is impossible to know why 35% of suspects killed by police are black, a percentage that is nearly three times higher than the rate of blacks over age 13 in the general population. Statistically, blacks are disproportionately more likely to be arrested for violent crime, according to the Department of Justice. The rate of arrest for violent crime per 100,000 people was 213 for whites and 1,022 for blacks in 1998. More elements of this report say that nationwide, from 1976 to 1998, there were 8,578 persons killed by police. They're called suspects. Remember, they're felons. So these that have been killed by police are 8,578. 56% of them are white and 42% of them are black. White officers, by the way, it says, makes up 87% of the nation's police forces. That's a big number. Isn't this the most diverse county or area, it's claimed, one of them, in the country? 87% of law enforcement officers are white. And 82% of the justifiable homicides in 1998 were committed by Caucasian officers. Now, to explain themselves, one officer by the name of Sergeant Smith and another, Sam Faulkner, a training specialist for Ohio Peace Officer Training Academy, says, when you're under stress, decision-making is really hampered. Goes further to say, Sergeant Smith, out of Ohio, a suspect's race doesn't matter when a gun is pointed at you. The only thing you care about is, am I going to survive the encounter? Okay. Oh, and you shoot to stop the threat. Then they offer the very famous police officer excuse statement. People say, why don't you shoot the gun out of their hand? I'd like to meet the guy that can do that. We're not Annie Oakley. Police trainer officers are not taught to, quote, shoot to kill. That's not true. They're taught to shoot to kill. They're taught to shoot to stop, which means that they will target the area of your body that will produce the stoppage. Therefore, they are trained to aim dead center to your chest. Now, with bullets flying through your chest, That is the equivalent of shoot to kill. So now, with these kind of numbers and the excuses that officer trainers are giving about officers under stress. Well, again, if the officer's under stress, how much stress was that term J.R. used in his article? That the rabbit got the gun? They got very angry with our brother J.R. Balroy after the Lavelle Nixon incident because he posed the question, what happens when the rabbit gets the gun? Now, we understand that police officers are under stress, but how much stress is the rabbit under? Since there's so much unnecessary contact made, it's already acknowledged in Justice Department records that the overwhelming amount of contacts made by law enforcement are with black males. Now, what happens then if the officers involved have some notion that to be a black male is to be a threat? Why are there so many shootings at black males? Well, the only thing you care about, according to the trainer, Sergeant Smith, is, am I going to survive the encounter? So now, what is it that was perhaps on the mind of Tony Perrone? What is it that was on the mind of Johannes Meserle? We can't measure and shouldn't even attempt to measure his facial expression. The coldest killers in the world laugh, some of them, while killing. What's the man's name? Charles Manson.
Yeah.
Cold-blooded killer. I've seen him do interviews on the press, and he laughs about the people that suffered under his organized effort of mass murder. Serial killer. They don't have any particular look. Jeffrey Dahmer in Michigan was an average-looking character. But he was out there eating people. So you can't tell me that because Johannes Meserle had a straight face that somehow that's an offer over what he was thinking when he pulled the trigger. He looked stupid when he got up there. He looked stupid when Oscar took his picture. Oscar took his picture on his cell phone with a taser in his hand. He looked stupid in the courtroom. I'm just telling you. I saw him walk out. They actually let him walk past us, Brother Bayard. That's about the first time we let him do that. He walked past us. And one of the witnesses, when asked, that he looks just like he looks right now. So when they ask the question, what did he look like at?
Right, I think he practices to look like that.
It doesn't mean anything that you can prove in court. You'd have to ask him on the stand, Mr. Meserle, why do you look so stupid? Now, I don't think they're going to do that. They want the police psychologist to come in and decree what I just declared. That when you feel threatened, that you're justified. That's why, quite frankly, what he said when this thing happened, we're anxious to find it coming to the court record. We want to see who's going to lie and who's going to tell the truth and who's going to wink at the judge. They brought out of one of the witnesses, and I watched Mr. Raines. He's a vivid note taker, so just watch him. When his pen starts working, he's found an argument.
Yeah.
They want to take Oscar's declaration, don't tase me, and make that some evidence that Meserle said while he was laying on the ground for 30 seconds, I'm going to tase him. There would not have been enough time. There would not have been enough time. Perrone was on Oscar's head. There would not have been enough time. As I understand it, Oscar said, don't tase me when he was sitting along the wall. Not when he was laying on the ground, but what they are trying to fabricate on the behalf of the defense of Johannes Mezeli is that Mezeli somehow announced his intention. I think he really said, I think he has a gun. That's what I think he said. I think he's reaching for his waistband. And to be quite frank about it, since it's very clear that Oscar was under the control physically of 500 plus pounds of human beings sitting on his 165 pound frame, that if it were their desire to handcuff him, clearly, no doubt, he would have been handcuffed. So as we're looking at this case unfold, the prosecution has yet to complete its presentation. The highlight, perhaps, that some have said in the general media, was the testimony of our young brother, Jamil, who at 15 years old had to witness the horrific killing of his friend. He captured that shooting with the closest camera of all of the witnesses. Now, he's not a photographer. He's a 15-year-old who had enough wisdom and courage to do what many grown folk would never have done. He realized right away, he testified, I'd never seen anything like this in my life. He couldn't believe his eyes, so he pulled out his cell phone camera. And as he was recording, it became apparent to him that the police were escalating their brutality against Oscar and Jackie and Michael and John too. Who else is on the ground? And Nigel. So now he's shouting at them and moving closer with the camera. As he's moving closer with the camera, Marisol Dominici and other officers were moving with him in an effort to keep him out of the police operation. He's shouting at them. I believe that's when he's shouting the N-word, get out of the way. N-word, get out of the way. They've beaten on my friends for nothing. And as the video played, we were nearing the lunch hour, and I just knew the judge was going to stop any moment anyway, but as we were watching the video when the shot fired, young brother Jamil, strong and bold and courageous, and we love him greatly, broke down on the stand. He broke down so strong because of the love of his heart for his friend that the judge was shaken. The jury was shaken. The audience, the family, you knew was shaking before we got there. The press broke down and cried. That's the passion that he brought to that witness stand. He said later that he hadn't seen that video for over a year. And he shared with us afterwards that he and their friends have not been looking at these videos. They cannot bring themselves to just sit down and watch these videos. And we see Nigel, we see Jackie, we see Michael, we see John too. These young men and others have been marked for the rest of their lives. This is going to stay with them. And you know, they've got something in psychology that causes us to black out the details of what happened, that this painful moment goes out of what they call the analytical mind. It goes somewhere. But it's with you. And it comes up out of you and can be triggered by nearly anything that you experience when you experience the pain itself. I saw a piece on Facebook one night. Oscar's sister was waiting for a ride to go somewhere. Now, I don't know if any of you saw this. And she had a panic attack because her ride did not come and she was going to have to catch the BART. This was about 6 months ago. And she cried out over Facebook. I sent her a message right back, and others did. And she settled down and made her way home. But can you imagine the anxiety that is in the heart of those that were on the platform with Oscar on that night? So we took the break. The judge was so shaken. This was the only time he wasn't real clear about what to do with the break. He's real stickler for time and courtroom space. In that, he'll say, we'll take a 15-minute break. Don't be late. And when you come in, your cell phones must be off. And, you know, all the rules that apply to that courtroom. This was the only time he wasn't real clear. We had to go back after we went out and ask them, what time are we supposed to come back? It was that moving of a moment in the trial. I'm sure there'll be other moments that are moving, but we're very grateful for all of those that took video, whether their testimony was crystal clear. Now, remember, these are human beings, and each are entitled to their view. However, we want to make sure that the prosecutor doesn't feed Mr. Raines any new weapons. So this question that they keep asking about what did Mezzali look like, someone said to me, and I don't know the validity of it, that you could have introduced the tape without all the people. I don't know. I'll have to inquire. And that may have eliminated Raines' response to each of them, which his primary question for all of them was, what did Mezzali say and what did he look like? When we returned from that lunch break, and Brother Jamil goes back to the stand, he goes on and attempts to explain whatever that alleged fight was on the BART train. None of the witnesses are real clear that it was actually a fight. There was a disagreement. There were men that put hands on each other. But be crystal clear, no BART officer saw anything like a fight. The BART officers brought a fight with them. So they didn't have any real information about who was involved in an alleged fight, except that somebody told them black males. Let's go back to the statement. The only thing you care about is, am I going to survive this encounter? How did they view their encounter with black males when they arrived to that platform? Marisol Dominici testified, and they all were recipients of, not in this case, in the preliminary hearing, they all were recipients of a call that said that they were looking for black males that had a fight. That only, what I just said, Brother Salim, you're right. When she runs up and says, I just knew I was going to have to kill somebody, that so shocked the black judge who had a different view. I want us to remember the view of Judge Don Clay. He said, and I quote, I have no doubt in my mind that you intended to pull a gun and not a taser. He went further to say, I don't need taser experts because no taser expert can explain to me what was in your mind. Only you, Johannes Mezzali, can explain what was in your mind. And I hope that the DA heard that judge because he's equally skilled as this man down in L.A. I hope we don't have white supremacist notions and think that Judge Perry is a better judge because he's white, or we don't have some geographical divisions and we think that if because you're a Southern California judge, that makes you better than a Northern California. That would be silly. Judge Clay is as skilled as Judge Perry. So for him to make that kind of very clear statement, that should say to the DA, you can eliminate all this psychological talk. Because none had examined Mr. Mezzali. Yes, sir.
I don't want you to forget this. You kind of left Jamil off.
Yes, sir.
Lorraine, actually, if you get any questions, Jamil, share with us about how Reigns kind of downgrade.
I will get there. Right. Well, Mr. Reigns went with Jamil to first discover more about this, what was called a fight. And Jamil kind of defused him on that. In fact, Reigns tried to allege that there was a gang conversation. Now, you might remember the young man that Oscar was said to have had the difference with. There was some sort of difference. I don't think that's at issue. Quite frankly, is irrelevant. Because no BART officer saw any differences. All the BART officers saw were black men standing around. So that Mr. Reigns attempted to pull out of Oscar's mouth words that would have the appearance of being in a gang. Now, this is significant perhaps more to Los Angeles than it is to here. So the dialogue went something to the effect of, oh, there's Dave. That was the other young man. And I think his son's name is Dave Jr. There's Dave. Well, who's Dave? Hey, we all know Dave. We've been around. Well, where's Dave? Dave is from the West. West side of Hayward, I guess that means. Mr. Reigns tried to construe that to have meant that this was a gang fight in the works. Now, Jamil said that it was their other friends that broke the fight up. If this was a gang fight, you don't break a fight up. If this is a gang fight, you step in and stomp somebody. But according to Jamil, they broke up the fight. But there was such a crowd, the fight didn't evolve into anything. So Reigns comes in with a picture of Michael Greer with a scratch on his nose, and tries to allege that that scratch on his nose came from the fight. Well, first, whatever happened is irrelevant. Second, who's to say Michael Greer didn't get that cut on his nose from Peroni throwing him against the wall and hammering him to the ground? I don't know where that picture came from. It's almost dumbfounding because Michael is smiling in that picture. So it gives me the impression that that picture had nothing to do with January the 1st, 2009. Now, Reigns couldn't get Dave into the courtroom, so he brought his picture in the courtroom. Dave came to the preliminary hearing and said, I ain't had no fight. Oscar was my friend from Santa Rita. We were cellies together, which came out in testimony. But yet, Mr. Reigns wants so vehemently to paint a picture that there was a brawl or a gang fight on this train, and that was his effort to try to do that. Now, at the conclusion of Jamil's testimony comes the real offense from Mr. Reigns. Reigns is a pit bull. The man has no heart at all. There's no mercy in him at all. I can tell you that now. Now, he does try to acknowledge in the opening arguments that a human being died who never should have died. A man was killed that never should have been killed. This was a tragedy, he said, but a tragic accident. That's his argument. But there's no heart in it. So when he gets 15, now 17-year-old, Jamil on the stand, he took a shot at Jamil. He's lucky Jamil to take a shot back with words. He challenged Jamil about why he cried. He said, Mr. Duar, you did testify in the preliminary hearing where you saw this tape before, didn't you? Yes. Well, you didn't cry then. Well, why? He said, well, it was closer to me at that time. Honestly. Because quite frank about it, when you're in fight mode, I'm sure it would, I didn't talk to him before he went in, but I'm sure when Jamil went in the preliminary hearing, he wanted to beat the heck out of Meslin. Is that fair to say? Fair to say. He gave Meslin the coldest look in the courtroom yesterday. On May the 18th, or whatever that date was, that he went into the preliminary hearing, he was still in fight mode. Justifiably so. Because at that point, he doesn't even know if Mesley is going to be bound over for a murder trial. So like any human being who doesn't know what's going to happen with the murderer of their loved one, he's got his own thoughts, whatever those thoughts are, and he's entitled to them. Is that right? So when he went in, as Nigel and Jackie and all the others, had they gone in, I can already tell you where their heart was. So when he walked in, he didn't have that in his mind. You don't have time to cry when you're fighting sometimes. Sometimes when you're fighting, you got to wipe them tears and throw some blows. Now, you were in Vietnam?
No, I just missed Vietnam.
You're just good. You saw some battle zones, though?
Close enough.
You know some men went out on those battlefields and women and cried and shot bullets. Is that right? Some had to wipe it out and keep shooting. So the fact that Jamil is crying, the whole courtroom having compassion for this teenager. Here comes Reigns. Yeah, right. Is that what he said? Something like, yeah, right. And then walked away from the the cross-examination.
Yes, ma'am. Can I just say this? In that time when they were questioning him and he began to cry, our soldiers deal and are we compassionate about them having a little shell shock from what happened in the war. This was the same
thing
in a different.
This post-traumatic stress.
So why are they sympathetic?
The same stress that Reigns defended the officers against when they went in after Lavelle Mixon and they had to set the SWAT team down for 2, 3, 4 months so that they could recover from that shooting scene. Now he's got surely compassion for the officers, but I thought the officers' duty was to protect and to serve. And if that is their duty, one would think that their attorney would have some kind of compassion for a young man that they were paid to protect and to serve, yet they murdered him. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I really agree with that. Because shock is a self-defense mechanism, like you were saying.
Yes, ma'am.
And so that you've got your guard up for a reason, so you can just get through the day.
Yes, ma'am.
But with time, a lot of time, boy, that's when the pain first to come in.
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of hard to say because we're so early in the trial.
Yeah.
There have been jurors who have not been as attentive as maybe we would like. I know Wanda Lynn complained. Once Reigns gets up, it puts you to sleep, I have to tell you.
Oh.
His method and the way that he's questioning the prosecution witnesses is a bit difficult to be attentive with. However, I think that Jamil's sincerity shines clear that you cannot just erase this as an accident. For if I were driving at 100 miles an hour on a highway and hit and kill somebody, I can call it an accident. But they never call it an accident when law enforcement comes along. They're going to come along right away, and this is going to be considered a crime. Yes, sir.
And I think kind of related to that, definitely one juror first time to see it. You know, the judge was like, wow, you know, they said, let's take a break. You know, they give no instructions. He was emotionally affected. Everybody was. One juror was visibly affected. She burst into tears. So when Reigns did that attack, I believe, personally, you know, especially with the one that had the emotion, probably got it. As well as us. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And Reigns actually got frustrated because he couldn't turn it the way he wanted to turn it. So I think he really ended his assault based on that. He knew that he would get ready to cross the line if he kept trying to drill to make the point that you faked.
Basically, that's what he wanted to say.
Yes, sir.
In a stress situation, like a war zone or murder, things will come back to you later. They didn't happen to you emotionally in the moment.
Yes, sir.
And something will trigger it, and then it all comes flooding up again. And that's probably what happened on the stage.
Oh, absolutely.
He hadn't seen that for a year. He had been pushing it aside, trying to get past it, and then there it was right in front of him. Something you said earlier about Leslie and also about Oscar. He said, Oscar said, don't tase me. And they were trying to make it out like he saw him have a taser. But he had been tased once before.
Right.
That's a traumatic.
And he well understood what that meant.
So he's in a high stress situation confronting an officer who he knows is capable of doing that again. He doesn't have to see a taser to say, don't tase me. That's like a kid who's been beaten, and all the father has to do is pull the strap and, no, don't hit me again.
And he had seen he had seen a taser because he took a picture of Meserly
right.
with a taser.
The last photograph Oscar took on his cell phone camera.
Perfectly logical reaction.
The newest video or photographic evidence that we've seen is actually Oscar's photograph. That photograph was as he was sitting on the ground. And there's some footage from other videos. You see when Oscar has his phone in his hand. So the idea or the notion that Oscar was offering a threat is really eliminated by the fact that he's talking on the phone, and he took that phone when Meserly arrived because Meserly came with taser in hand and pulled that taser out more than once and put it back in its holster. More than once. So the idea that this man, who within 2 minutes had been to that taser twice, but then in the moment of killing Oscar, he don't know where he put it. Within 2.5 minutes, he had that taser in his hand twice in the cross drawer. It was mounted on his left hip. He cross drew that taser twice.
Where was his gun?
His gun was on his right hip.
He doesn't know the difference.
Well, we all know. We all know. So here's a concern, though, that we should be very clear on. Because the prosecutor has not objected to anything that Mr. Raines has said nor done. Even if Mr. Raines said, yeah, right, the prosecutor should have said, I object to badgering our witness. He's making a statement to the jury. That's from the attorney, it's not from the witness.
That's an objection of argument. It's an argumentative objection.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm glad you're raising that because that was one of my questions, too. Has the prosecutor come up with any expert witnesses around weapons? And is there a plan by the prosecutor to bring in the holster and the gun and the taser?
He brought the various holsters in the opening argument and demonstrated how they are so significantly different. How the weapons are so significantly different, how the pulling of them. I've never handled those sort of weapons, so I couldn't have told you till I learned it in the courtroom, the mechanisms that are involved in the holster of a police officer. So they're mechanical devices that are distinctly different. That's why Mr. Raines is trying to argue where Meserly's thumb was, because the mechanics of getting them out of these holsters are entirely different. And getting them to the point of using the trigger is different. That's how we know. Raines, I think, tripped himself up when he said that Meserly, as other officers, fires that service revolver. I think he said 1,000 times. That he's fired that gun 1,000 times. Now, if you've been using something 1,000 times, then you know exactly where it is. You know what's in your hand. You know how to fire it with your eyes closed. You know how to get it out with your eyes closed. So if he's a soldier, and he is, Brother Bobby was in the Army, didn't you all have to put your guns together blindfolded? Did they do that to y'all?
Yeah, in the dark.
So you had to learn how to handle that weapon in inclement conditions, under stressful conditions. They might even put you in tear gas in a little room and make you figure out how to get your weapon together while you're under this duress. Is that how they handle them?
Yeah.
Now, they may not put a police officer in that, but surely Raines did acknowledge that the man was well-trained on a gun. Now, whether or not he was trained well on a taser is fine, or obviously what? That's why Barton's revamped their whole taser policy. However, he's exceedingly well-trained on a gun. So let's go back to Judge Clay. I have no doubt in my mind that you intended to pull a gun and not a taser. Yes, ma'am.
Then has the DA come up with any explanation?
They haven't been to the stand yet. But since he's introduced in the opening argument the holsters, the types of weapons.
But yes, sir. He actually had his very first witness.
Right, I said that before you.
Oh, you did.
Is there like a weapons expert and a psychologist?
No,
he
hasn't
called him. Not yet.
He's not done with his case right now.
He's
only examined the videographers that he's used to this point and one other witness who actually came out of BART. I hadn't seen him before. Who was a passenger on the, I forget his name, but he was a passenger on the train that night, big young man. He just had a good view of Peroni attacking Oscar and his friends. Like Mr. Liu, he seemed to have the temperament that suggested that if black people are attacked by the police, what did they do? That seemed to be his view. But even though that was apparently his view, he was clear that they hadn't done anything. That Peroni, and he kind of expressed it, that was his view. So it wasn't a guesswork. His view was you should comply with the police and do those kind of things. And he couldn't believe what he was saying. Now, evidently, whatever happened in the investigation with BART, he kept quoting what happened in the BART investigation process where they asked him about his recollection of the events. And he quoted about four times what happened when the BART investigators came to him. Yes, ma'am.
One last thing. The point about Peroni, the expression on his face after he murdered Oscar.
Mesley's
face, is that you can have the intent to kill someone, you can do it, and afterwards realize you made a big mistake because you didn't come up with
me. Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? So that look, maybe I'm so shocked, oh my God, I just did this in front of everybody, but that doesn't change the intent.
Absolutely.
If I can add just really quickly,
yes, sir.
Out of the way, and it happened to be, it came to my realization for the first time because I'd never seen it before, but what was real major is that after he killed Oscar and went so on called for him for emotion, he then decided to roll Oscar over and knee him in the back. Bang! Right where the bullet goes back, and then proceed to handcuff any man that was traumatized by an accident and did, would not have been able to follow through with that type of accident.
So you wouldn't all of a sudden be a stickler for BART policy.
Exactly.
Handcuffing somebody that has been shot because they may be a threat.
Right.
If you shot them on an accident, they were never a threat. So one would imagine that first aid would have been his response, not handcuffing. Yes, ma'am.
I've been in the jury, and from start to finish, no matter what happens during the trial, when you sit in that jury room, you have absolute vision from start to finish. So they will not forget, even if they forget, that beginning when that young man, 17, was brought up there and was out of jail, all that information comes from start. And you will sit there, you will argue, you might agree or disagree, but you will have all the
yes, Mr. Judy.
Well, the picture of mentally holding the taser, was that new to the family?
Yeah, it was all new to us, too. Well, Oscar, the very last picture he took was of mentally with a taser in his hand, and that's what his whole case took.
And I would say that God leaves the door open.
That's right. That's what you call a smoking gun evidence.
That shocked me.
The idea that Mesley did not know where his gun was.
Right.
And we had a press conference, and I want to thank Bobby. We've been organizing our engagements with the press so that we don't oversaturate and give them more than they really want. And we should know that you should not expect from the general press accurate reporting. I was speaking with the sister a little while ago, Sister Ann and others, about the fact that in Los Angeles, you've got the largest, one of the media markets in the world, certainly in the country, and that there are so many homicides there that most of them do not even reach the news. Brother Bobby and I went on KJLH Radio, which is owned by Stevie Wonder, 4:30 on Thursday morning before the trial. And there were listeners. Some came to the courtroom as a result of listening to that radio show. But the host of the show, Dominique Dupree, was her name, seemed to feel that everybody knew about the case and that all we had to do was to make an announcement. The reality, everybody does not know about the case. So as we were talking with one of the journalists after Jamil testified, he felt, being from Los Angeles, that that wasn't good testimony, and he'd seen hundreds of cases, and you know, that was his opinion. Okay, you're entitled to your opinion. However, what you don't know is the full range of what had happened. You would have a more clear picture as a journalist if you had done some journalism and found out who all these characters are before you got in there to report. Unfortunately, the journalists that we often see work for the corporate media, and when it comes time to present the report, doesn't meet with the compassion that we saw in the courtroom. As Bobby was being interviewed yesterday, I don't forget what channel the young lady is from, but she was in tears.
NBC.
She was in tears. So you had to interview him off camera because her eyes were, she was crying from the compassion that she felt for what happened in there. But you don't see that compassion in the general news reports. What you get in the general news reports is the sterilized version and sometimes the altered version of what happened in there. So you leave with the idea that all wrong is happening. However, you know, be clear, we're the underdog. So it's not that all wrong is happening, but you know, you got to knock out a champ. And no police officer in the history of the country has never been convicted for murder in the first or second degree while on duty for this kind of action. Never. That's a never. Never in the country have we won one of these cases. So our duty now becomes to make sure that it's on every mountaintop. Every ear should hear what happened in Oakland on January the 1st, 2009. Every eye should see what happened in Oakland on January the 1st, 2009. All should be aware of what's happening day to day in that courtroom, because when the jury renders a decision, the police are already called. OPD wants to know what we're going to do. Are we going to give a Rodney King speech? They already asked it. They won't ask me. But they're already asking. The feelers have already gone out, and they're seeking to do a preemptive Rodney King speech before the verdict comes. Well, okay. Yes, sir.
This last photo that Oscar took, was he lying down or was he in an upright position?
He was sitting upright.
So we know that he didn't take a picture messily with the taser in his hand while he was lying face down on the ground.
The reason that they claim to have had difficulty handcuffing him, the claim is that he wouldn't lie down, but that's because they laid him over the leg of his friend. So he couldn't lie down flat. His hands were in front of him in some fashion. So to get his hands behind him, he's on the young man's feet, you know, it's just an awkward position. So when they pull him up and put him down on his face and they claim that he's resisting, it's because they laid him in an awkward position. There is no physical evidence. There's no video evidence that Oscar nor his friends were actually involved in resisting arrest. None. And that's been fairly clear through all of the video testimony at this point. In fact, the event that caused Peroni, allegedly caused him, I don't know what caused him, but seemingly caused him to hit Oscar, was Jackie was talking to Domenici. And they were talking. And they were talking. Jackie didn't like, evidently, as none of them did, that they were being detained and how they were being treated. I think it's after Michael was slammed or thrown into the wall.
Yeah.
He was thrown into the wall. So they're talking, why are you doing this? Jackie is talking with his hands like I'm talking with mine. He's not less with his hands than I'm talking with mine right now. But he's animated. Oscar, as Jackie is a foot or so away from Domenici, Oscar puts his hand out and calls his friend back, in essence, to say, calm down. He pushes the young man back away from Domenici, and while he's doing that, Peroni comes and blindsides him. In a very cowardly kind of way. So, in defense of what they won't allow into the court record, what some believe was his personal relationship with this young lady, in defense of his young lady friend, he runs up, perhaps feeling she's being threatened. Where is that quote? The only thing you care about is, am I going to survive this encounter? He might have felt that Ms. Domenici wasn't going to survive this encounter with these young black men. So he engaged Oscar in a brutal way. Oscar still didn't fight him. He sat down. And when they put him down, the handcuffing, he complied with that too. Because they're the Keystone Cops and they couldn't lay him down straight. That does not account for resisting arrest because these officers are the Keystone Cops. Jamil, to his credit, refused to call in police. He said, didn't you know they were police? No. I thought they were security guards or something. Well, why'd you get back on the train? Because them security guards, no, Bart, please. Them security guards, no, Bart, please. No, security guards. That was it. Well, didn't you know that they were law enforcement? No. How would you know? How would you really know? As a teenager who's trying to get to school or a teenager going to the mall, how do you know that these police officers are actually police officers? I'm hearing the strangest things about these off-brand police departments nowadays, of which BART is one. They had an incident in Southern California, if I recall, where the school police pulled somebody over and got into a shootout. Pulled somebody over? Why in the world are the school police pulling anybody over? Then they said school police pulled somebody in this area over and got a carload full of bags of marijuana, they claim. Now, unless that carload was on the campus, what in the world does school police have to do with a carload of anything? Y'all with me now? So you got all this hodgepodge of activity. So now you got BART police who never ride the trains. Now, they're concerned with crime on the train, one would think they'd put on the uniform and walk the train. I've never seen a BART officer on a train. Like they do in New York. I've never seen it. They sit out and drink coffee in the parking lot. They wait for high school students to go to Fruitvale BART station to have a rally honoring Oscar as the opening arguments were preparing to be made, and they come out there with 100 students, and they come out there with the whole BART police department. Where were those students from? Was it Hayward Highland? A group of high school students with banners in their hand had to be confronted by 200 officers at the Fruitvale BART station last week. That's why I ain't seen them as rental cops. And when they testified in the preliminary hearing, they were angry that they weren't respected as other law enforcement agencies they think are respected. But reality is, on the other end of that gun, are people who have problems with the police. After Operation Nutcracker, Lieutenant Joyner cried out at a West Oakland town hall meeting at Acorn about the fact that when firemen drive through the neighborhood, children wave at them. But when police, himself included, drive through the neighborhood, people give them the finger. That's what he said. That's, again, because of the historic relationship between black folk and the police. It didn't come out of a vacuum. We ain't mean people. We're the most loving people on the planet. Be honest with you, as mothers and fathers of civilization, everything goes with black families. Y'all remember watching Roots? Do you remember when the Civil War ended and Tom goes into the little store and there's a poor white guy that after the war he didn't have food to eat, so he tried to snatch something or stole something out of the store. The Klansmen came in and saw Tom, the black guy there. They said, "Okay, Tom, you know what this is." And they take him out and they whip him like slavery still exists. Now, Tom told them, "I didn't do anything. It was a white guy that had just robbed this home." Do you know that Alex Haley's family, the same white guy, came back hungry to their door. Tom's wife invited her in. "Come on in. What's your name?" His name was Tom, too. "Oh, my husband. Here, have a bite to eat." And when Alex Haley's four-parent Tom comes in and sees, "That's the man that got me whipped." "Oh, Tom, it wasn't his fault. It was the Klansman that whipped you. That man right there is just hungry. Give him a bite to eat." And by the time they were done, they didn't only give him a bite to eat, they gave him a place to stay, they gave him clothes to wear, they gave him family relationship. And when they finally got out of that community, away from the slave master's plantation, they took, they called him Old Tom, they actually took Old Tom with them to the new neighborhood. So when you find these young black people who are angry with the police, it's not because they're racist, it's because we've been brutalized.
Yes, sir.
Well, it's clear, and it's already stated in the Justice Department statistics, that contact between African Americans and law enforcement is disproportionate. Jamil is no different from these. Now, these four young men, to my knowledge, have never committed a crime. However, without even asking them, I know two of them have been sitting in the car when the police pulled me over. But I didn't commit a crime. And had Bobby's children been with him when he was harassed a few weeks ago? If he had smaller children, they'd have been traumatized by that. And if I were to ask the other two, I'm sure they have seen. If they haven't experienced it themselves, they have seen. We can just ask Brother Osiris, "Have you seen the police do anybody badly?"
"Yes."
"Brother Sharif, have you seen the police do anybody badly?" "You have. Any other children witnesses?" "Brother Gary still has an engram. He's fighting off some old memories of police brutality." "Sister, we've seen it. We've experienced it. Oscar experienced it. So he not only was tased, he was beaten when he was 18 years old by law enforcement because he allegedly fled a scene and hid from them underneath the car. Well, if you've been a witness of brutality, they're not as old as Oscar was, and they've already seen bad circumstances. They're all under 15 or so. Now, they've seen it. Oscar certainly saw it by 18 and had experienced it by 22. So what was their response when, as Jamil said, these mean-looking security guards came running up, looking like they were going to hurt somebody? They got back on the train. They got out the way. And then when Peroni gets there and says, starts her cussing at them, you know, I don't want to say it in church. We've heard it before. But when Peroni gets there and starts cussing at them, Jamil never did get off that train. Not for that. So Peroni came and got Oscar off the train. Peroni came and got Michael off the train. Peroni went right and bumped into Jamil, going to get Michael off the train. But Jamil never got off that train because here's a wild-eyed, crew-cut-wearing, big buff, gun on his hip, cussing out, using foul language, man, shouting at him on the train, and he's 15 years old. In fact, he didn't even know who he was talking to. Peroni came and said, you know who you are. Get off the train with the cuss words. Well, Jamil held his position. Wisely so. Michael held his position. Wisely so. Oscar held his position. Wisely so. But when he came and grabbed them, they submitted. They didn't pull back. By the way, there's cameras inside the train. I don't know if they were running. I haven't seen that yet in any evidence. But there are cameras inside the train. You all ever ride, Bart? And you look up in the ceiling in the center, there's a camera with a blinking red light on it. Now, whether or not they're actually using it, who knows? But there's certainly the technology there to record. Just how they caught that young man that beat somebody on a bus in San Francisco. They've got cameras on these transportation modes. But sisters and brothers, we want for the community to be fully aware. There will be some of us in the courtroom each and every day. And we encourage you, if you can, spend a day or spend some time in Los Angeles, engaging the community. The community is not well informed over what's happening because these kind of things happen so much in Los Angeles that perhaps they're not seeing it quite well yet. The media is not giving it the attention there that it gets here. So now it becomes part of our mission to make sure that not only Oakland, Los Angeles, but really the entire country is as fully informed over the details of this case as is possible from us, from our vantage point. I'm very grateful for the Los Angeles Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant. Can we give them a big round of applause? We put on an art show, or participated in an art show of Oscar Grant art. I wasn't able to go. Bobby went, and I heard it was wonderful. I've seen some of the images. There was in downtown Los Angeles, and I guess a full art show. And part of the art show was dedicated to art concerning Oscar Grant. And what I've seen has been very, very wonderful. And so, Age, I don't have his last name, is it Patterson?
Yes.
Age Patterson, who's been helping to organize down there in Los Angeles, to show you how strict this courtroom is. I understand that during the jury proceedings, his cell phone went off, and they excused him from the court proceedings indefinitely, right, for the duration of the trial. Now, if you're interested in going, those that go, you should know that there's a lottery process in order to get in. While we have not had great difficulty, there's still some difficulty in getting in, and those that are able to get in the lottery process are only guaranteed to sit in one session, either before lunch or after lunch in that session. So if you're interested in going to Los Angeles and sitting in on the trial, there's always something to do even if you don't get in, by the way. But if you're interested in sitting in the trial You need to arrive to the courthouse at Temple and Broadway at about 7:30 or earlier in the morning to catch them as they're giving the tickets out. They will do a drawing at 7:45 that morning for the 8:30 trial. They will pull 10 tickets. That's how many public seats there are. So the rest of the seats are devoted to the Grant family, the Mesley family, and I haven't seen any of them yet, and the press. Perhaps the Mesley family has opted not to come, because I surely haven't seen any of them yet.
Yeah, it was mentioned that they are not appearing. They have not been appearing.
Right, they have not appeared at all, that I can tell. This is one person or so. Yes, ma'am. I think that Sister Ann, we and those of us that have been gathering together will have to drive that. So soon, actually, we'll be gathering a meeting here at Olivet of community leaders from all over black community leaders from all over this area in just a few weeks. And surely on the platform of our dialogue is to pursue this case beyond the state charges. The Justice Department should be involved. The question is, who can make them get involved?
Now, I...
Yes, sir.
You know, maybe if I'm talking about, you know, who I know, I just share how Sharpton will be there Monday.
Yes.
And that prior to, you know, our conversation before this coming Monday, we had talked about he wants to get the Attorney General, Justice Department. He said he's going to make enough noise that they all begin to move.
Well, God willing, we'll see and we'll help him.
Yeah.
So that, of course, we would like for Reverend Sharpton to help bring this case back to the front of the mind of the community. And in some manner, he has some connection to the Obama administration, and that should surely include a connection to the Attorney General, Eric Holder, to monitor and make sure that this case goes as a case really should go. Sister Ann, we will help. So whether Reverend Sharpton is involved or not in the process, God willing, I'll be able to return to Los Angeles and engage Reverend Sharpton to help connect what we're doing here to whatever it is he's doing from New York or D.C. or from wherever he's based.
Yeah,
yes,
sir. You know, we talked about the theory, you know, about, you know, listening to the young brothers and the young men. You know, and it's a sad note that part of the way that they eliminate jury members is what kind of relationship or feelings that they have for police when it comes to these issues. And as we've just seen, all our young people have had issues with the police, and not so much personally, but the fact that they know someone that's been affected. So how can we eliminate a jury that's going to contain some African-Americans if that question be asked?
That there's concern over the speed with which the jury was selected. They had to throw one juror out as soon as they started the first day. So, and we don't know why, in terms of what the judge explanation was to the attorneys. That was sidebar conversation. However, the jury was selected after a questionnaire, which you can find much of on the internet. And there were questions that would have excluded any one of us. Yeah, do police officers tell lies? That's why we're here. Ask me no stupid question. They lied when they said I was speeding once. I mean, if that's the question, then you're excluding jurors, particularly black jurors. Do you believe that racial profiling exists? Of course! Have you ever been a victim of racial profiling? Of course. The questions that were asked in the jury questionnaire were so slanted. You heard it said perhaps that academic tests are called culturally biased. Well, that questionnaire was actually culturally biased. It was designed to weed out people who had any experience with police brutality. And once I went through those numbers, I just went through about the abundance of contact between black people and law enforcement, then you know that we already have an impact on us by these experiences. It turned out that when they selected the jury, they excluded all of those that had those experiences, but they included those whose family and friends are police officers. So we're concerned about the jury. We can't change it at this point. But that's why it becomes important that the federal court and the Department of Justice be involved in this process. We don't want to see what happened with Rodney King. We don't want to lose the game and then have to find out later, or we'll give you another shot at it. Because the second shot is never the equal of the first, by the way. So when those officers went in after the Rodney King beat, I heard or I read one L.A. Press call Oscar's murder Rodney King light, like Bud Light. This is not light. This is heavier than what happened with Rodney King. But this is a capital offense. So for them to make the comparison that this is a lightweight version of Rodney King, stop it. L.A. is not that special. Human life is far more important than geographical region and reputation of a city. It wouldn't matter what city that you're in. If innocent life is taken, that life is not given less value by Almighty God, who sees life as life. He's not going to devalue the life because of the neighborhood you live in. He's not going to devalue the life because of your past experiences. He's not going to devalue the life because of the color of your skin. That's not our way. That's their way. So when they call this Rodney King light, see, they're trying to downplay the power and the impact. Remember, no peace officer in the commission of his duty has ever been convicted for murder in the United States of America, period. Now, do we get a size of the fight? You got a size of it? That's okay, we got a lot of fight in us now, don't we? So this is not something we're backing away from. So we're going to have to take some time down in Southern California, those who can, and those who have contact, that we will continue to organize and uplift our people for the demand for justice in the murder of Oscar Grant. We got about 3.5 or 4 weeks left of trial. I think the prosecutor is close to concluded. He has not brought those experts yet. Sister, I hope that he brings them. We'll send a little note to let him know that we're not pleased with the fight with Reigns. The man has to fight Attorney Reigns. I don't know if he thinks he's complying with the judge or something, but to let Reigns have full reign is not going to get it. He's going to have to raise his objections. I'm told that during the jury selection, when you wonder why there are no blacks on the jury, that there were 5 in a jury pool of approximately 50 people. Well, that's, what, 10%? Okay, well, that's not so bad given the demographics of Los Angeles. But as soon as they walked into the room, the judge pulled out his pen. And 2 of those 5 were out right away. Then Rain stepped in with his, I think they call it perfunctory challenges.
Yeah, 3.
And there goes the other 3. I was told that with each of those 3, or 2 or 3, that the DA could have challenged that person. Now, I don't know who those persons were in terms of jury selections. There's some science to it, so I can't claim to know. Someone wrote in one of the papers, well, the jury over the Riders trial had a black foreman, and just having a black person there is fully what you want. I understand that. But I have a problem with the DA if he has a challenge to Mr. Reigns. Not making it. They took the dialogue to a private sidebar. So whatever his challenge was whatever privacy is in that, And I don't know, Brother Gray, maybe you can tell me, is that part of the public record when they do that?
No, sidebars are not a part of the public record, but the strategy has always been that each side has three actual challenges. And you use your challenges very carefully. The defense will get the first challenge, the prosecution, or the moving party, usually the prosecution will get the first challenge since they're a moving party. But they use their challenges very carefully, so they would not challenge your challenge. They would prefer to hold those challenges for a later time for people that you appear to be more interested in.
That sounds good. But the Lakers and the Celtics are in the fourth quarter.
Right.
It's game seven right. of the series.
Right.
There's 30 seconds left in the game. The Lakers have the ball and the Celtics need to get the ball back. They're down by 4 points with 30 seconds in the game and they're going to have to find a way to stop the clock so that they can prepare and set their offense and put some points on the board if that's what the desire is. They're going to have to figure out a plan to defend the Lakers and get a steal if you can. Or you're going to have to find the weakest ball player on the Lakers at the free throw line and foul him. So if Shaq was still on the team, you find a way to foul Shaq because he's not going to make the free throws. Okay. But you've got 30 seconds left. Three timeouts. Now, if you don't use one, shame on you. Now, I don't know. I've not heard that the DA used one. And in these first 2 days of testimony, the prosecutor has not objected to anything. You know, at least fake it. I mean, I watch courtroom TV. About to make me stand, Your Honor, I object. That'd be my last trial date. But if he does not object to anything, that means that, and Raines has made several objections. Just on the strength, object. There's no thing.
Now, how many of Francis's objections were sustained?
I don't recall.
How many of them?
Yeah.
Or sustained meaning he could go on court.
No, sustained meaning that if he objected to it, the sustaining means that the judge is in agreement with him and he stops whatever's going on.
Oh,
the overruling is that if he overrules the objection, then they can continue on.
Right. Whenever he's
sustained means the judge agrees.
The judge would agree with the objection and stop whatever is going on.
Well, whenever Rain raised it, the judge always said, yeah, that's speculation.
Okay, that's so it.
He tells the jury to disregard the
information. That's
so sustained. He knows how to, whenever Stein says something that's very powerful, Rain objects to it, the judge agrees. And then he has to rephrase the question.
That's sustained.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But also the question of the jury sees that. Because the jury's looking, it's not just the rational argument. It's who do they see as fighting hard for the key? And so Stein's got to step it up.
Absolutely.
Just whether or not he's going to be overruled or screen or whatever.
We don't want to.
He's fighting for his key.
We don't want to see him get to the last 30 seconds with three timeouts.
We have posted notice. Just recently, matter of fact, yesterday, on our way back from LA to accomplish that, we feel very Stein needs to be the objective more to Stein's way of questioning and the way he attacked. And like I told my sister, he said it in his motion, Monday is going to be an extreme day for subpoena. Because Rain says that if she testifies, she opens herself up for a full assault attack. And he's going to tear her up. And just the same way he, you know, was messing with Jamil, he's going to try to destroy her or anybody else that represents us. So it's real important that Stein objects to those attacks.
Well, it's not before the...
Yes, sir.
But it's not before the defense to come vigorously. The pressure that the family needs to put on Stein is that he must
vigorously defend
620.
His case.
Well, yeah, that's what we're saying.
Where there's room for objecting, object. Where there's room for raising concerns, raise those concerns. Where there is a need to challenge the testimony on the defense's part, he needs to do so. He needs to vigorously defend his case, because that's not what he's doing.
And he needs to find the way to object to that which is entirely irrelevant.
Right.
Remember,
right.
Subpoena's testimonies will have to do more than anything else with that phone call between Oscar and Subpoena downstairs. Reigns wants to talk about the alleged fight, which is entirely irrelevant to the shooting of Oscar. Now, let me say that we're beyond time here in our church, and we don't want to hold the staff here longer than we have to, as the weeks are going to get bigger over the coming weeks. Tell your family, tell your friends that we'll bring the most recent updates on the case, but what is it that you can do? Again, if you're interested in going, plan your trip. Know that if you're going to be at the courthouse, you can't come late. There's no getting in the courtroom late. You'll need a lottery ticket. There's only 10 public tickets available, 5 for the morning session, 5 for the after lunch session. But all of those 10 seats are secured at 7:30 in the morning. So they'll issue 5 for the morning, 5 for the afternoon. Do your part. Maybe you can send your concerns to the district attorney, O'Malley, and let her to know your concern. You're hearing that Reigns is doing the fighting, and it looks like the prosecutor is not fighting on the merits of the case in the courtroom. He did a decent job in his opening argument, his opening statement. But in terms of jousting with Mr. Reigns, he's going to have to pull out his sword and get busy. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense that we, without pay, can pull out our sword and come back with Mr. Reigns. And he get $150,000 a year and let Mr. Reigns cut this case down into shreds. Remember that the prosecutor is actually the underdog, and he has to know that. In this case, he's the underdog. Therefore, he needs to go for a knockout. That's not something I'm going to joust round for round and outpoint my opponent. In this kind of game, he got to knock that man out. And that's the only way he'll find victory. Not going to find it doing what you normally do, because you don't normally convict a cop. What you normally do is take the cop's word and convict everybody else. So since we're not doing what's normal, then we'll have to ask that the prosecutor go beyond what's normal and offer the kind of challenge that has to be offered to Attorney Reigns. He's a million-dollar attorney, but that don't make him right. That just makes him well paid. So we're demanding that the prosecution be full and vigorous, because there's a history that says that it won't be. And so we're thankful and grateful to each and every one of you. Hope we brought you the updates in a way that's clear and understandable. The family is going back down. Perhaps many of the days there'll be no trial on Wednesday. Wednesday is an off day, I guess, because of the budget cutbacks. So it'll be Monday, Tuesday, then Thursday, Friday. The court times are 8:30 to 4 in the afternoon. And again, to get your seat in, you should be there between 7 and 7:30 to get your ticket into the court procedure. Next week may be more difficult, because the Michael Jackson doctor's case comes into the same floor in court on the same day. I think that starts Monday. So there'll be more of a crowd. But that simply gives us really the platform to make our message known. So the LA Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant actually is planning for a rally outside the courthouse on Monday. I don't have the time.
8 a.m.
At 8 a.m. Monday, they'll be gathering at the courthouse. It's right across the street from City Hall. So if you can get to City Hall, you're at the courthouse, which is right across the street. Come on and encourage your friends and families to support justice for Oscar Grant. Y'all all right? Thank you very much. We didn't get a chance to cover the other issues that we had on our itinerary. Yes, sir.
To everyone here, if you're interested in following up to look at the footage that we take every week and stuff that's on YouTube, Base Perspective TV. We upload this footage every week so that at least the community will know what's going on here at the town hall meeting.
Thank you so very much, Brother Greg and Brother Dave, for keeping the record and making it known so that the community can be better informed. So as we opened in prayer, we should close in prayer. Would you all please stand? Let us pray. In the name of the Lord God, the beneficent, the merciful, all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, the beneficent, the merciful master of the day of judgment. Thee do we serve, and thy name we seek. Guide us on the right path, path of those upon whom thou hast bestowed a favor, not the path of those upon whom your wrath is brought down, nor of those who go astray, say, Ye Allah is one God. Allah is he of whom nothing is independent, but upon whom we all depend. He begets not, nor is he begotten, and there is none like him. I bear witness that no God deserves to be served, no worship but the one God. And I bear witness that Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad are his messengers. It is in the names of all the righteous that we pray and say together, Amen.
Amen.
Salaam.